I was Fidel Castro's first American prisoner. On July 23, 1959, I was arrested with my son Edward, who at that time was 13 years of age. He was released after being held 5 days while I spent 40 months in Castro's communist dungeons. I was released on October the 7th, 1962. Here are some of the details of my story. I don't have time on this record to give more than just the highlights. The rest you can read in detail in my book entitled I Was Castro's Prisoner, published by Devin Adair. When my son and I were arrested, I was accused of being a pilot and of having flown to Cuba in my private plane, and was engaged in arms running and counter-revolutionary activities, which of course was false, as I arrived in Cuba by Pan American Airways. When I was taken to the police station, I naturally asked to call the American Embassy to inform them of our arrest. This was refused me. In fact, when I made the request, I was struck in the face and knocked down by the chief of police. I was interrogated all that night until 5 o'clock in the morning. I kept denying their charges and asked how my son was. They told me he was all right and that I should not worry about him. I was then placed in a cell and held incommunicado. I was in that cell for 3 days. In the meantime, while there, I was questioned relentlessly. On the fourth day, I had my first contact with the American Embassy. This came about by accident. I heard someone in the hallway speaking English. I shouted out to him and asked him who he was. He came to my cell door and told me his name was Wayne Gilchrist from the American Embassy. I told him who I was and what had happened to me and my son. He told me he had been looking for us, as my wife had reported us missing since the night of the 23rd, but that the Cuban police had denied knowing of our whereabouts. I asked him to go and find out if my son was okay. He told me he had to call Mr. Hugh Kessler, another embassy official. When I asked him why, he replied that he did not talk Spanish well enough. "My God," I said, "and you work for the embassy?" He did not reply and walked away. A day later, a Mr. Kessler came to see me. He told me my wife was in Havana and that my son was going to be released. "What about me?" I asked. He replied that I was being held for investigation and that the law would take its course. I then explained to him that I was sick and under a doctor's care. This doctor's name, I told him, was Dr. Gustavo Esteves, and if he would please notify him as to where I was and to send me some medicine. He told me he would take care of calling the doctor and not to worry. The next day, Kessler came with Dr. Esteves, who examined me, and they both left. Kessler came back about an hour later, and he told me that Dr. Esteves had told him I was not sick. I said, "Well, that is strange. How could he say that?" He replied that he was puzzled. I then told him to check with the health department, as my records were there from my doctor in the States. He acted as if I was lying to him. That was the last time I saw Mr. Kessler or anyone from the embassy until the last week in August. 2 days later, I was transferred to Castillo de Atares and put into an underground cell, which had no water or toilet facilities, filthy and crawling with vermin. The only window in my cell looked down into the moat that surrounded the castle. I was escorted by an armed guard any time I had to go to the toilet. During this time, I was very sick. I kept asking for help and for the embassy, but no one paid attention to me. It was during these days that I discovered the presence of a Russian military mission at the castle, and that they were using a radio transmitter at night. The last week in August, the commandante of the castle asked me if I would like to talk to someone from the embassy. I said yes, and he called the embassy and told them I could have a visitor. The next day, Wayne Gilchrist and another man from the embassy came to see me. The guard let them into my cell and locked them in with me. The first thing I told Gilchrist was about the Russians and the radio transmitter. This is how he replied. "My God, Martino, do you realize what you are saying? They might have the cell wired and are listening. I don't want to get into trouble. Please don't talk about such a crazy thing. You must be making this up." I said, "Gilchrist, what I am telling you is the truth. Go back and report this." After discussing my case, he left. 2 days later, Mr. Kessler came to see me. The first thing I said to him was, My God, why can't you see that I have medical attention, as I have been very sick? He replied that my case was a very delicate one, and there was really nothing he could do for me. I asked him if he had checked with the health department. He replied yes, but there were no records on me. We talked a while, and he left telling me again that my fate was up to the Castro government. My wife was given permission to see me. The day she came, I was cleaned up for the visit, given a haircut and a shave. She was very nervous, but we really couldn't discuss much, as an English-speaking guard sat with us. She told me that the embassy had written to her and that I was in good health, receiving good treatment, and not to worry. What could I say with the guard sitting there? She also told me she had been in Washington, talked to our congressman, Dante Fussell, and the answers were all the same. Don't worry, and that Cuba was such a touchy subject. There was nothing anyone could do for me. The reason why I am talking about these things are, since my release, I have been warned not to talk about what happened to me. And don't talk about the State Department's neglect in my case, as I would be helping the communist enemy by bringing these facts in the open. I feel that the facts should be made known, as I do not owe my freedom to the State Department, which, if you read my book, is self-explanatory. To continue with my story, my wife left and I was led back to my cell. I did not hear from the embassy again. On October the 3rd, I was taken to a suburb of Havana called Marianao to be processed. I was given permission to call the embassy. I talked to Kessler and asked him to be present at my arraignment, but he refused, saying he was too busy. The laws of Cuba are different than ours. When you are arraigned, or processed, as they call it, you are brought before a judge who listens to the arresting officer's testimony, and then he has 72 hours to either release you or to hold you for trial. In my case, neither of the above happened. I was given a confession to sign where I admitted to being a pilot engaged in gun running and taking people out of the country. Upon my refusal to do so, the judge told me he was going to hold me on the charge of counter-revolution. I asked him how, as I was not a pilot, which I could prove, and surely was not a counter-revolutionary figure. He held up a piece of paper and said, "Do you see this?" I asked him what it was. He replied that it was a bond for $100 made out to an organization named the White Roses, which was a counter-revolutionary organization based in the United States, and that it was found in my pocket when I was arrested. Therefore, because of my refusal to sign the confession, he was holding me without bail on the White Rose charge. I said, "You must be crazy." He replied that those were his orders. I was then taken to the city jail of Marianao to await transfer to Castillo del Principe for my trial. To my surprise, the chief of the jail treated me kindly and didn't even put me in a cell. The chief told me he knew all about me and that he wanted to help me, as he thought I was innocent of both charges. He asked me if I would like to call my wife in Miami. I was dumbfounded. Here I was being treated like a human being. I called home, and while talking to my wife, the chief, whose name is Medina, told me to tell my wife to come to Havana right away, as I needed help very bad. Also to bring documents proving who I was and so forth. He then asked me if I wanted a lawyer. He would see that I would have one. All the while I was in jail, I had been told by Kessler I had no legal rights and could not have a lawyer, which I had just found out was not true. My wife arrived the next day with documents proving my business connections, how I had gone to Cuba, and why. He told us both he would do anything in his power to help me. My wife told me that she had been assured by the embassy that I was receiving medical attention and I was being treated well, which was not true. She also said she had been to see many people, but always received the same answer. Cuba was a touchy situation, but not to worry. While I had been in prison, she also had tried to see Ambassador Philip Bonsall, but could never make an appointment to see him. I wish to say at this time, although she tried many, many times, she was never successful in her attempts to talk to the ambassador. After talking the things over, she decided to go to the embassy and try to get help. The chief of the prison, Medina, offered to go with her, which they did. Upon their return, my wife told me they had discussed my situation with Kessler and Consul General James Brown. They assured my wife that although I had been processed on this new charge, that I would not be moved to the prison. Chief Medina told Brown that I was very sick, as he had sent me to the hospital as I was hemorrhaging, but the committing judge would not sign an order permitting me to be put into the hospital. Brown told my wife if they moved me, she was to come back to the embassy. That afternoon, the guards came to take me to the Principe, but Medina told them that he would take me himself. Chief Medina, together with an unarmed guard, my wife Florence, his daughter, and myself, got into his car and, to my amazement, drove to the American embassy. Reaching there, I said, "Why are we here?" He answered, "To get help for you," and we went inside. We proceeded to the office of Consul General Brown. In his office were the following embassy personnel: Hugh Kessler, Wayne Gilchrist, William Mullen, Brown, Gustavo Alemán, and ourselves. When Brown saw us, he said, "My God, Martino, what are you doing here?" He was visibly upset, and Kessler asked Medina if he realized what he had done. Medina replied, "I brought him here so that you can help him." Brown said, "We can't do anything for him. You must leave here at once." At that, he hurriedly left the room. Medina turned to me and said, "Your own people don't want to help you. I don't understand it." Everyone was talking at once. My wife was frantic with worry and was demanding to see the ambassador. Kessler said he was out of the country. Brown came back and said to me, "Martino, you can't stay here. We don't want any trouble with Fidel Castro. Do you realize the scandal this will make? We are having enough trouble with him now. Why, Ambassador Bonsall hasn't been able at this late date to confer with him." Medina said, "Mr. Consul General, if I call a friendly judge on the phone, I am sure you can get Martino into the Anglo-American hospital, paroled in care of the U.S. Embassy." Brown didn't answer him. All he did was mop his brow. They all were nervous and upset. Chief Medina, in the meantime, called his friend and asked his friend the judge and asked Brown to talk to him, which Brown flatly refused to do, saying that he could not interfere and would not have anything to do with the problem. Medina hung up the phone, turned to me, and said, "Martino, what will you do now? I am in a bad position. Your own people are against you." My wife spoke up and asked Brown if he didn't think I should be in the hospital. He answered yes. Brown was called by someone. He left the room. When he came back, these were his words to me: "Martino, as a good American, I want you to go to the Principe, and I assure you that in 24 or the most 48 hours, you will either be free or in the hospital." My wife asked me what I thought. I replied that I was innocent and didn't want to make trouble for the embassy or Chief Medina. We left the embassy. Little did I know that I would rot in Castro's dungeons for another 37 months. Once in the Principe, I was put upstairs in the so-called infirmary, together with 16 other political prisoners. There were 12 bunks in the cell. The rest slept on canvas cots. For 17 months, we were never permitted to exercise or to leave our cells. We were guarded night and day. We never were in the sun. It was a treat to have enough water once in a while to bathe. We were like caged animals. During visits, which were 1 hour every Saturday, a guard stood over you, and naturally, being American, my guard understood English. I had to be very careful of every word when I talked. I would talk to my wife as she would come from Miami to see me. From October the 5th until my trial, December the 18th, I had two visits from Mr. Kessler. He told me he was sorry about what had happened, but there was nothing he could do for me. I was taken to La Cabaña on a stretcher for my trial. I could not walk. I had lost 30 pounds and was getting weaker steadily. My wife attended my trial. My lawyer tried his best. He destroyed the false charges of the bond. As in questioning the police, one testified he found the bond in my pocket. The other said he found it in my suitcase. He asked for a mistrial, which was denied. The court recessed, and when my trial started again, the prosecution produced two witnesses who testified falsely that they had witnessed me and my son while making a landing on the highway outside of Havana in my plane. This military kangaroo court convicted me. My lawyer immediately filed an appeal, and I was taken to Castilla del Principe. At my trial, no photographs were taken, and there also was a complete news blackout. The American Embassy never protested my conviction by this kangaroo court. To the contrary, my wife was told publicity would be bad for me. Incidentally, my sentence read that I was a criminal of war. I stayed in the Principe until January the 3rd, 1961. I was transferred to La Cabaña Fortress. From the day I entered La Cabaña Fortress until my release 20 months later, I was not permitted to write or receive letters. I was shut off from my family completely and didn't know whether they were dead or alive. I was put in cell block number 14, which I was to discover was the death house, as all prisoners who were in number 14 were to be shot and were held incommunicado. La Cabaña Fortress overlooks Havana Harbor, high on a hill. The prison compound is entered by crossing a drawbridge and is completely surrounded by a moat. There are 11 cell blocks, numbers 7 through 17. They are entered from the patio. They are all underground, dark, dank, with a musty smell. One goes down a flight of stone steps to get into them. They have no windows. The only source of ventilation is an opening at the back, which has a 12-high foot railing, which prevents you from the source of ventilation. Standing in the patio, you can look up to the roof and see four 30-caliber machine guns, one on each corner of the courtyard. 10 armed guards are always on the roof. There was no way to reach the roof from the patio. The cell blocks are 120 feet long, and each had 50 bunks, with the exception of number 14, which only had 17. In number 14, there were, when I entered, 12 men who were waiting to be executed. In early January 1961, there were only about 500 prisoners there, but soon La Cabaña would be filled with an average of 1,600 to 2,000 prisoners. La Cabaña is the transfer point to the Isle of Pines, known as the Green Hell. You were either executed or went to the island. During my 20 months in La Cabaña, more than 20,000 men passed through there. Of these, I lived and talked with 294 men and boys who were murdered by the communist firing squads. In La Cabaña, one is born every day because the life of a prisoner is worth nothing. Every 24 hours brings a renewal of the tension, hunger, and misery. The day begins at 7 a.m. Breakfast consists of two fingers of cold black coffee and a hard roll. Lunch and supper consist of boiled macaroni and pumpkin and a bean from China that the Chinese use to fatten up hogs. Most of the time the food is cold. You must force yourself to eat in order to survive. The diet is one of starvation. Men fall apart, especially the strong, sturdily built ones. After the Bay of Pigs fiasco, we were allowed one pint of drinking water daily. Often the communist guards would purposely forget to turn the water on. Many times the water would be turned on at night when we were not permitted to move about. The sound of running water would almost drive one mad. We had one toilet and one washbowl. After the Bay of Pigs, we had an average of 180 men in cell block number 14 alone. The stench of unwashed bodies and of the sanitary facilities was unbearable. There was no medicines or hospital facilities. When you were sick, it was a question of doing the best you knew how. There was a commissary, but there was never much to buy. Many days there were no tobacco or cigarettes to be had, as Cuba, once famous for tobacco, was sending it all to Russia. The week following the Bay of Pigs invasion, our prison was primed with dynamite, for Fidel Castro has sworn that if Cuba is invaded again, he will blow up all the prisons of Cuba. I know that this is so, as I saw when the dynamite was placed under the cell blocks. This has been confirmed by other prisoners in other places. Before I continue further, I would like you to know that these facts. Since my book has been published, The State Department, in answer to queries from newspaper men, has issued a statement by John King of the Public Information Bureau that, number one, there was no record of John Martino ever being in the American Embassy on October the 5th, 1959. Number two, they never heard of Hugh D. Kessler. Number three, this is not pertinent because I am free. Number four, that they did send me medicine. My reply is that I would like to produce witnesses and testify before the proper authorities in order to clarify and substantiate my charges. Now I will try to describe the communist prison system of Castro's Cuba. When a prisoner is arrested, he or she are generally taken to a city jail for temporary detention. There, his or her family can visit them and bring food and clothing and toilet articles. From this place, they are taken to G2 headquarters, where he now receives two visits a week, food, clothing, and etc. Then to La Cabaña, where visits in normal times are 1 hour every 2 weeks, no food or clothing, where conditions are as I have described them. There he awaits trial by the kangaroo courts. If not executed, he is sent to the Isle of Pines, or the Green Hell, as it is known. The Isle of Pines consists of four circular buildings, six stories high. Each floor has 93 cells, built to house one prisoner, but now hold four or five. There is one toilet to each floor, no running water. Every morning, a prisoner is allowed 1 pint of water. To bathe, some days salt water is pumped in and is used. Since the food is often bad, diarrhea is rampant. Waiting for the toilet is impossible, and they are obliged to use the floors and corridors of the cells. These men live in conditions of indescribable filth. Then there are the searches at 3 a.m. Everyone is prodded out into the yard at bayonet point, made to stand in the nude, more or less at attention. This generally lasts for 14 to 24 hours, with no food or water for the prisoners. Many faint. Sometimes the guards let their fellow prisoners pick them up. Sometimes they don't. The guards delight in tossing everyone's clothing in a heap. You can just imagine how long it takes to get one's clothing back, if at all. Many nights the loudspeakers are turned on, and you lay there listening to Fidel Castro rave and rant with his 5 to 6 hour long speeches. So you see, my friends, each step is worse for the prisoner. This is all calculated to degrade a person to the utmost. Many persons resist this, but there are many who cannot and turn to the communist schools of indoctrination in order to receive better food and clothing. These prisoners are taken out of the prison, such as La Cabaña, at the Isle of Pines, Casa Boniato, Castilla de Atares, Castilla del Principe, and sent to prison farms, where, if they meet the new standards, are paroled to their families. But if they fail, or are thought to be faking, are sent to the many small islands adjoining Cuba and put into concentration camps where they are forced to work at hard labor.